I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books and translation. It may surprise you to learn how many books you may have read in English that were originally written in other languages. Joining us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And author Peter Abrahams. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Mindy and Jill. Hi.
This was your idea, but before we go to why you wanted to do this, Jill, something I never really thought of, but there are a lot of books in this category that I think people would be really surprised.
There are a lot of books. And when I started thinking about this, this was Peter's idea. And I think it turned out to be a great idea. I'm really interested in the whole idea of translation. But what I suddenly said, suddenly thinking, well, when did I first read translated books? And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, I first started reading translated books when I was a small child, because there are so many classic picture books that, in fact, began in other languages.
Babar would be
absolutely, and you would not think that
Madeline, right?
Madeline was French, right?
Yeah, Babar as well.
And there is Pippi Longstocking by Astrid Lindgren, which has a brand new edition. Well, brand newish. It's new to me, of the translation of Pippi Longstocking. And one of the great things about this is they also got a new illustrator, and so it has really changed the whole feel and look of the book. And there are so many levels, as I have learned in the past month, of translation and what people do with translation and the arguments over translations. There is lots of controversy. And one of the biggest controversies is about the new and actually, this translation, I have to say, is apparently 10 years old. I only just discovered that The Little Prince, which is a classic book by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, and I will say, having read this when I was in 10th grade French class, I do have a strong feeling about the original translation, but it turns out I'm not the only one. So when this new translation came out of The Little Prince, there were a lot of complaints about it, and with good reason. And let me just read you. I've got both editions sitting in front of me, one which is actually stamped Falmouth Free Public Library, which gives you an idea of how old this book is.
1940
this is a 1943 copyright. Still in great shape, may I say.
A
little worn
like
for the wear.
No, they don't make them like that anymore.
So just to give you an idea of how translation can change everything depending on who the translator is. So here's the original sentence. Well, and when I say original, it's every translator is telling a story in that translator's own way. So this is, again, the translator's language, but interpreting the original. Once when I was 6 years old, I saw a magnificent picture in a book called True Stories from Nature about the primeval forest. It was a picture of a boa constrictor in the act of swallowing an animal. Here is a copy of the drawing. And then when you read, which seems pretty straightforward, but then when you read the new edition, it says, once when I was six, I saw a magnificent picture in a book about the jungle called True Stories. It showed a boa constrictor swallowing a wild beast. Here is a copy of the picture. So they've cut out primeval forest for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. True Stories from Nature has become True Stories. It's now a jungle instead of a primeval forest. I mean, really, the whole tone of it is different. And there was somebody who went through this, the whole book, and wrote a very disparaging article about what has been changed. And here's another. This is a great example of what can happen in translation. The original translation was, if I had 53 minutes to spend as I liked, I should walk at my leisure toward a spring of fresh water. Mm-hmm. Lovely sentence. And now in its place, Howard, who is the new translator, who, may I say, is a poet as well, so it's not that he doesn't love language, has translated that line to, if I had 53 minutes to spend as I liked, the little prince said to himself, I'd walk very slowly toward a water fountain. Now, anyone who doesn't think water fountain is different from spring of fresh water, mm-hmm. they have very different ideas in your brain.
Well, it's, you know, who knows what their marching orders were. My take on when a new translation comes, I think they often feel that the other one is dated. because it's not as idiomatic and up to date. And my feeling is there's not just a lot of charm in some of the old ones, but sometimes a better feel of what was going on.
Yeah.
But of course, then there's the whole commercial aspect. Right, a brand new translation.
New
and free are the two big words in advertising. Free is obviously a non-starter, so you go with new. But going back to the reason I thought of this is actually kind of you suggested it. It's all I read that, and maybe it's already happened, that Google now has or will soon have earbuds with a handset that will simultaneously in real time translate 40 languages.
Wow.
So in other words, let's say you're in a bar in Croatia and you have it on and the bartender, he'll say, what'll it be in Croatian? You'll hear what'll it be in English. You'll say a beer and a shot in English. He'll hear it. And, a minute later, you'll be drinking your beer and your shot. So you might say, okay, this kind of translation is going to be very primitive. It'll only be for, things like that, just simple transactions. But with artificial intelligence, the translation there's no reason why eventually it won't learn to be artful. This is a very, very scary thing to me. So that's got me thinking about books in translation.
Yeah.
And the human element.
And some of your books have been translated the other way, from English
into many, many languages. But see, this is the problem. I don't know if they're any good.
Yeah.
So in reverse, when we're reading in English, we can tell if it's good writing. Right?
Because we speak English.
But we can't tell how accurate it is.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking that. I mentioned to both of you before we went on the air. I'm thinking just even subtitles in movies. Sometimes I remember seeing La Cage aux Folles, the original French version, and the English subtitles, and I would go, wait, they just totally missed the joke right there. They missed so many. I mean, you got the basics, but there was a lot that was missed, and I wondered if that happens when we're translating books as well.
I'm sure it has to. It has to.
Yeah.
I wanted to be methodical about this, but it just it fell apart. But one of the books, I brought books that I think are kind of important, and so I thought, well, I'm going to look at Kafka because Kafkaesque, right? You could take The Castle or Metamorphosis or The Trial, and I picked The Trial because it's so scary. It was written in German. Kafka was from Prague, and actually so he spoke he wrote in German, but he spoke German I think with a Czech accent, strangely enough, even though he had it from birth and he did his writing. And so it begins with this famous sentence: someone must have slandered Joseph K, for without having done anything wrong, he was arrested one fine morning. And it just captures so much of the totalitarian state. But the process, in other words, he's offended. There's never a trial. We don't know ever what the crime is. He lives in fear, but at the same time goes about his daily life and finally is executed at the end and almost cooperates with it. And yet we never know. So this strange book, and which was written, I think 1905, 1906, but it wasn't published till after he died. He had tuberculosis. He died at a young age. He instructed his literary executor, Max Brod, to burn everything, his papers, most of which hadn't been published. None of these novels had been published. But Max Brod disobeyed him, and that's why we have the trial.
Wow.
That's why we have the trial.
All right. Jill, what's your next book?
Well, I've brought a book called Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Translation and the Meaning of Everything by David Bellos. There have been a number of books about translation that have come out in the past few years. And I think that it's in part because translators themselves often feel not appreciated as much as they think they should be. And there is some really funny comments that they get about their translations. But in this this book, he talks in his prologue about what translation means, what the word means. The meaning of the word translation is not without interest, of course, and I've devoted one chapter of this book to the issue, but it isn't as important as many other questions that arise just the same, whatever word we use. Here are some of those other questions. What can we learn from translation? What does it teach us? Many others then spring to mind. What do we actually know about translation? What is it about translation that we still need to find out? We also have to ask, what do people mean when they offer opinions and precepts about the best way to translate? Are all translations the same kind of thing, or are there different operations involved in different kinds of translating? So it gets to be a very deep and sort of compelling discussion of what goes into translating. And I think it's fascinating, Peter, that you have no idea whether your translation, your books have been translated well or not. And when they get reviewed, that's another big issue with translation, is that often the translator is totally ignored because the reviewer is thinking about the author, story, not the story. And one of the chapters in this book about Is That a Fish in Your Ear? Says the number of, it's called How Many Words Do We Have for Coffee? And he writes, the number of New Yorkers who can say good morning in any of the languages spoken by the Inuit people of the peoples of the Arctic can probably be counted on the fingers of one hand. But in any small crowd of folk in the city or elsewhere, you will surely find someone to tell you Eskimo has 100 words for snow. The great Eskimo vocabulary hoax was demolished many years ago, but its place in popular wisdom about language and translation remains untouched. What are interesting for the study of translation are not so much the reasons this blooper is wrong, but why people cling to it nonetheless. Mm. So I too thought, I mean, I was, until I read this, I thought they did have 100 words for Eskimos.
But it's one of those urban legends.
Yeah. Exactly. So it has sort of fascinating little bits about all kinds of different kinds of translations. And it has a section, as Mindy was just talking about, the subtitles on subtitles. Mm-hmm. And what a business that is, and how difficult it is to be translating, and all of the various things that happen when you try to translate into a film, and it has to be read. Mm-hmm. So what he says, it has become conventional to regard average moviegoers as capable of reading only about 15 characters per second. And in order to be legible on a screen as small as a television set, no more than 32 alphabetic characters can be displayed in a line. So somebody can be having a huge long conversation, and you know that because you're watching it and you're hearing it, but you're only seeing one little bit of it. So every kind of translation has a challenge. And this book is That a Fish in Your Ear by David Bellows, Translation and the Meaning of Everything.
It sounds like it would be a really tough job, you know, the translator. And I wonder, are there, you know, in the world of translators, are there people, I would like that person to translate my book? You probably didn't have any say over who translated.
No, you don't. But sometimes I've been contacted by the translator.
Oh.
You know, going outside the process, saying what, just, especially if it's some kind of idiomatic American word. These are totally fluent people, but maybe they don't exactly get
it. Sometimes there's not a word for it.
Yes,
right?
And I really enjoy, well, of course, that's the thing about English. Compared to every other language, we have way, way more words. And that goes all the way back to the history of England. I mean, so there were two infusions of Latin. And there was and one came through the French and one came through Julius, you know, when the Romans were there. And then there was the Norman French that came in, and then the Anglo-Saxon. So it's there's so many. We have like kingly, regal, royal, right? Royal's French, regal's Latin, and kingly is the Anglo-Saxon. And they all have subtly different meanings. So it's, the language is so rich, and that will be a problem in a language that only has one word for that. And then you want to figure out, what's it going to be? Yeah. So you have to have a real feel. But as to the question, do some people, you know, have a reputation? Certainly in Russian, these two people, Richard Peaver and Larissa Volokansky, they've done War and Peace, and the book I brought today, Crime and Punishment, and their reputation is absolutely Sterling. So I brought Crime and Punishment, originally written in Russian in about 1866 by Dostoevsky. I love this book. It's a deep, deep book, and he's a deep, deep guy, Dostoevsky. But this is also a crime novel, okay? Mm. And I, you know, I've done a lot of crime fiction. So I just... You know, the main character, there's a lot. What Dostoevsky was up to in this book had a lot to do with radicals in Russian politics at the time. You don't need to know any of that. Like the name of Raskolnikov, who's the main character and kills the old pawnbroker. Raskolnik is one who splits or dissents in Russian, which I just found out. But you don't need to know that, but it really guides you into what's going on. But so the Russians have a word called bespredel, and it means a kind of chaos that happened where events just spiral out of control. And this happens when Raskolnikov, so he murders the old pawnbroker, and who's a nasty old woman. And the crime goes, it's a terrible crime. And he doesn't even find the gold. He just steals some, like, knickknacks. He's desperately poor and feverish. And he doesn't even get what he came for. And then on the way out, he encounters, because he hasn't planned this, the sister, the pawnbroker's sister, who's just this simpleton, a sweet old, not a bad person. And this is bespredel, how something spirals out of control. Lizaveta was standing in the middle of the room with a big bundle in her hands, frozen, staring at her murdered sister, white as a sheet, and as if unable to utter a cry. Seeing him run in, she trembled like a leaf with a faint quivering, and spasms ran across her whole face. She raised her hand, opened her mouth, yet still did not utter a cry, and began slowly backing away from him into the corner, staring at him fixedly, point blank, but still not uttering a sound, as if she did not have breath enough to cry out. He rushed at her with the axe. She twisted her lips pitifully, as very small children do when they begin to be afraid of something, stare at the thing that frightens them and are on the point of crying out. And this wretched Lizaveta was so simple, so downtrodden, and so permanently frightened that she did not even raise a hand to protect her face, though it would have been in the most necessary and natural gesture at the moment.
Yikes.
Okay, so the translation is great, and of course the power of a writer like Dostoevsky. And following this second murder, Raskolnikov falls into this feverish state. Dostoevsky is just so brilliant on fever and poverty and Russian society. It's a book that will stay with you.
Yeah. That image is going to stay with me for a while, Peter. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to make a suggestion of a book in translation for us. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is Books in Translation today with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you would like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And a reminder, we will have a link to a list of all the books we talk about today a little bit later on our website. Jill.
Well, bouncing off of the book Peter was just talking about, and the same translators, I brought a copy of Anna Karenina by the same translators, who are Richard Peaver and Larissa Volokansky. And I thought this was the best, having read originally Constance Garnett. You may have heard of her. She used to be the translator for Russia. I mean, she translated everything. Anna Karenina, The Brothers Karamazov, Crime and Punishment. So everything I originally read in translation in Russian was by her, translated by her. But then this new translation came out, and I thought, it was so great. And it gets to your point of it sort of modernizing the language and trying to make it more relevant. But then I read this great article in the New York Times, which was written by Masha Gessen, which is, there have been two more translations of Anna Karenina since this one came out. And she writes this really fascinating little section about how one sentence and how that's translated makes such a huge difference in how you feel about the characters, what you know about the characters. So she begins by saying, what difference is there between being repelled, being repulsed, being disgusted and being offended. Not much, perhaps, but consider the scene. Anna Karenina has taken a sip of coffee and raised her eyes to look at Vronsky, her lover, who is watching her. After hundreds of pages of love, lust, passion, fear, exhilaration, disappointment, exhaustion, aggression, and probably most important, jealousy, they're having their final fight. And she goes on to say that, consider this. So Anna lifts her coffee cup, and she says when she lifted her coffee cup, she extended her pinky away from it, a precious gesture that signals just how far this domesticated, miserable Anna has come from the glamorous young woman she was at the beginning. And then she gives the four translations of this moment when she picks up the cup and moves her pinky. Now, you wouldn't think, you know, it would be, how different could it be? Well, it turns out it could be really different. So in the classic translation by Constance Garnett, the sentence is, she saw clearly that he was repelled by her hand and her gesture and the sound made by her lips. In the popular 2000 translation, she clearly understood that he was disgusted by her hand and her gesture and the sound her lips made. And then in a new translation by Rosamund Bartlett, she understood clearly that he was repulsed by her hand, her gesture, and the sound she made with her lips. And in another new translation by Marion Schwartz, she clearly realized that he found offensive her hand, her gesture, and the sound she was making with her lips. And what the writer of this article says, surprisingly, all the translators ruled that the part of Anna's anatomy that she believed repelled, repulsed, disgusted, or offended Vronsky was her hand and not her arm, though the Russian word ruka can mean either. I happen to think Tolstoy is writing about the arm, one of those two full arms that were so beguilingly set off by the black gown Anna wore to the ball in Part 1, Chapter 22, when she and Vronsky fell in love.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. But, okay, it's interesting to see those four things. I mean, I have a favorite. I think found offensive is the worst, you know, even if it's the most accurate, because it's too clumsy. Disgusted, I think, is too strong. Repelled is a little more neutral, but very, very powerful. That was the one I liked the best.
Yeah. Who wrote Repelled?
That was the original, Constance Garnett.
Then I'm with her. Then I'm with her.
That's really interesting. All right. What's next on your list?
Well, you know, I went back to childhood and I picked The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas. And as I started reading it, it's a wonderful swashbuckling adventure about this Gascon young man who goes to Paris to seek his fortune. And I love the advice his father gives him. This is his only birthright. Never avoid a quarrel. Seek out the hazards of high adventure. Fight at every opportunity. So, but it's a swashbuckling adventure of these musketeers who fight Cardinal Richelieu's men. Interestingly enough, they're called the musketeers, but muskets never come into play. It's all sword play. But you know what? I think this kind of adventure, like I read it as a teenage boy, I just don't see teenage boys reading it now. It's too slow, and there's just too many references that they won't get. But in it, I noticed that Dumas referred to Don Quixote as a kind of model. So I had a look at Don Quixote, which I hadn't read since a trip to Spain long, long ago, and I read it in a cafe, and I love this book. And so now we're going back to 1605, and some people say this was the very first novel. Cervantes, who wrote it, had a fascinating life. He was wounded at the Battle of Lepanto. He was enslaved by the Arabs in Algiers. Late in life, wrote Don Quixote in two parts. It was a sensation, but his publisher cheated him and he never had any money. But Don Quixote is this Hidalgo, which is the non-landed gentry. So if you're gentry, you want to be landed, because in Spain, the non-landed kind, I mean, you had the title, but not only had you no land, but you were forbidden to do like ordinary work.
You're so, in trouble.
Yeah. So Don Quixote is in love with tales of chivalry. And he goes on this quest you know, the impossible dream, I suppose, to bring chivalry back. Now, I thought of reading the famous tilting at windmill scene, but I thought, you know, with all we have going with our windmills here, it might ruffle some feathers and make people unhappy. I didn't want to do that. So there's another scene that I've always loved. This book, he invented so many modern techniques of writing, you know, kind of not really metafiction, but where you stories within a story and all this kind of thing. He just does it so easily. But Don Quixote goes to this puppet show. And in the puppet show is one of these, they're doing one of these scenes of chivalry with the Moors and the knights. So he's watching the puppet show. And so it has to do with Moors and Catholic lovers, and the Moors are chasing the Catholic lovers. And so he's watching the puppet show. And Don Quixote, seeing and hearing so many Moors and so much clamor, thought it would be a good idea to assist those who were fleeing. These are the puppet Catholic lovers, to assist those who were fleeing. And rising to his feet in a loud voice, he said, "I shall not consent in my lifetime and in my presence to any such offense against an enamored knight, so famous and bold as Don Gaferos. Halt, you low-born rabble, do not follow and do not pursue him unless you wish to do battle with me." And speaking and taking action, he unsheathed his sword, leaped next to the stage, and with swift and never-before-seen fury began to rain down blows on the crowd of Moorish puppets, knocking down some, beheading others, ruining this one, destroying that one, and among many other blows he delivered so powerful a downstroke that if Master Pedro, he's the puppeteer, had not stooped, crouched down, and hunched over, he would have cut off his head more easily than if it had been so much marzipan. Master Pedro cried out, saying, "Your Grace, you must stop, Senor Don Quixote, and realize that the ones you are overthrowing, destroying, and killing are not real Moors, but only pasteboard figures." Okay, and coming to the central problem that Don Quixote has with reality and non-reality. But this book is just so rich. I can't judge. This is a new translation by Edith Grossman, and it was not the one I read. Mm-hmm. And I liked it better, but it's been so long since I read it. But you find out what Spain is like, and so many other and those times, so many other things in a story that's funny and gripping and very moving at the same time. Just a wonderful book.
It'd be interesting for you to go back and read the one that you read as a teenager and see what you think now, because we've talked about this before, how you're in a different frame of mind.
Absolutely.
A book can seem so different as when you originally read it.
This is so true. And also that the language that you thought was so, that moved you so much when you read the original version, could be completely different, you know, now that you've read this version.
Oh, yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you don't know what the Spanish language at that time, I mean, there's so many unknowns in this. So in the end, what you've got is the product, this thing. Do you like it or not? And anyway, Don Quixote, just a wonderful story.
Yeah. Well, and I love that you were originally reading that. And did you say you were in Spain?
In a cafe, you know, just, yeah. And so it, in the south, it just, and the Spanish sun is shining. So you're half, you're halfway into the story before it even starts.
Well, and I think traveling to other countries is a great way to discover new authors and most of which need to be translated. I was actually in Rio when I discovered the next author that I'm going to be talking about. And may I say, if you ever have the chance to go to Rio, the bookstores are spectacular. But they, of course, don't have a huge English section. So I was looking for anything that had been translated into English. And one of the things that I found was a novel called December Heat by Luis Alfredo Garcia Rosa. And this turns out to be a series. And I have to say, mysteries have had a huge increase in I think mysteries are probably translated more into English than any other kind of fiction at the moment, including poetry and everything else. And because they're very popular and the plot keeps people moving, mm-hmm. I think, so they don't get hung up on the language. But this particular series is about this guy named Inspector Espinosa, chief of the 12th Copa Copacabana precinct in Rio de Janeiro, and is middle-aged, unmarried, and frequents used bookstores when he is off duty. But he can navigate the streets of his native city and match wits with some clever murderers. And one of the great things about reading his novels, his mysteries, is that you do really get the sense of Rio. He has because he has such a sense of it. And here's just a little bit about both books and his knowledge of Rio. He owed his taste for reading to her. This is his grandmother. At first, with the hunger of the dispossessed, he'd read anything and everything. Slowly, he'd begun directing his interest toward English language writers. In spite of this intimacy with books, he didn't much care for intellectuals. He liked to read, but he nurtured a secret disdain for criticism and literary theory. His reading included not only Melville, Chandler, and Hemingway, but also a healthy serving of authentic pulp fiction. This interest often led him to abandon Copacabana for extended visits to the used bookstalls downtown. It was important to him to draw out these expeditions, to create a whiff of adventure that doubled the pleasure of the find. When he was transferred from the downtown precinct to Copacabana, he gained something priceless, a commute he could cover on foot in no more than 10 minutes. And then it talks about his routes and what routes he takes through town and how he gets there. So there's a lot of description of the town. And one of the most interesting things about this Siri is that the guy that wrote these didn't take his first stab at writing until he was 59. He was a professor of psychology and philosophy at Rio de Janeiro's Federal University and very interested in psychoanalytical and philosophical theory. And there are now, I believe, 7 books in the series. And what's great about this series, unlike so many other series, as the author says, the fact that they all share a main character and setting doesn't imply that you need to be familiar with the others. The books are completely independent of one another. The reader can read the last book first, the first book last, or in any order they choose, which I think is great.
That's because great, yeah.
I find it very annoying to have to read 10 books to start at the beginning. But this particular book is December Heat by Luis Alfredo Garcia Rosa. Great mystery writer.
And I think that I've written a couple series, including the Chet and Bernie. And of course, Chet and Bernie's narrated by a dog, so it wouldn't make sense to have to read one and a different, you know, right. The first before the second, because Chet doesn't think that way. But I like the idea of writing them so that they're self-contained standalone books that happen to be part of a series.
Lee writes, we English readers were astounded by the work of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and we have Gregory Rabazo to thank. His translation from Spanish to English was truly extraordinary. He tells a story that, quote, a 100 years of solitude was how the masterpiece was sent to him. It was Rabazo who tweaked it to 100 years of solitude, which put Garcia Marquez into our libraries. Mm-hmm. Lee, thanks for that. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. We're talking about books and translation. You're listening to The Point. With us this morning, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Liz sends an email. This is a fascinating subject. It's come up often in my reading group, where we appreciated the Vilonsky translation of Anna Karenina immensely. Also, the Lydia Davis translation of Madame Bovary and Remembrance of Things Past. Although I had a London bookseller wrinkle her nose at her Americanization of the Proust sidewalk instead of a pavement, for example. And if, let's see, and as if only English is the only legitimate version. One small point, Madeleine was not written in French. Ludwig
Bettelmann.
Many thanks for a wonderful program. Okay, thanks for that correction.
Yes, thanks for that
She seems like she's French.
Yeah, no, it was me who made, and I messed that up. So, sorry.
Chill.
Well, as she mentions Lydia Davis, and Lydia Davis is a really fabulous translator, as well as she writes her own stories, these very, very short stories, which I love. And I think that I brought with me the two translations. And of course, Proust had, I tried to read, I will say, a good translation, and sometimes that does mean modernizing it in some way, can really get new readers for something. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I tried to read the original translation of Swan's Way, which
Moncrief.
Scott Moncrief's translation, and I just couldn't. I mean, I don't know what it was. And then there's a new, whole new group of books came out. And actually, for each volume, they decided to have a different translator. But the first translation is by Lydia Davis for Swan's Way. And again, it's that thing where it can be the smallest little change that makes a difference. And here is just the first sentence of, you know, and Proust is not known for short sentences, but this is very short. The original translation was, "For a long time, I would go to bed early." So, you know, very straightforward. For a long time, I could. But the Lydia Davis translation is, "For a long time, I went to bed early." And just making that little change makes the whole sentence sound a little differently. And I think that there have been great arguments over which, you know, is Lydia Davis's translation any good? Believe me, there have been many articles written about how awful it is that people who love the Moncrief. And again, I think part of that is when you come to it, you know, and part of it is that they just really think she was being too colloquial. Mm-hmm. She was not being, but she was trying to make it readable. Mm-hmm. And I love the beginning of the Publisher's Weekly Review about the translation that Lydia Davis did, in which the first line is, "Relax. It's fantastic." There's no question the Davis's American English is thinner and more literal than C.K. Scott Moncrief's archaically inflected turns of phrase and idioms, at least as revised by Terrence Kilmartin and later by D.J. Enright. And that had, so it had many levels of translation. The removal of some of the familiar layers of the past in this all-new translation gives one a feeling similar to that of encountering an old master painting that has just been cleaned. The color seems sharper and momentarily disorienting, which I think is a great way to describe it, because that's sort of how I felt when I started reading the newest translation. And so, you know, you'll either love it or you'll hate it. And I think that's true of many things that are in translation. Yeah. And sometimes it's really clear that it's just so awkward to read, you feel like something went really wrong with the translation. And other times it just reads beautifully.
Yeah, but sometimes I think if there's like a classic like this that you want to read and you've had a hard time reading the original translations, maybe checking out some of the newer translations, you might, as you were saying, you might find now you can get through it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. right. Yeah. It is part of your brain. I mean, I don't know how your brain works through translation exactly, but it is really fascinating how one sentence can make such a difference.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
As a writer, I'm sure you know that.
Well, yeah, that's the job. You find the, first of all, the way that expresses you, and secondly, hopefully, that no one else is doing, mm-hmm. but that works on many levels and has power and beauty. I mean, that's so. The next thing I went to after Don Quixote, I thought, well, what else from the time period? And of course, Don Quixote 1605, 1611, the King James version of the Bible. Now, I would submit that this is the most important translation ever made. I think it forms one of the pillars of our language. So many expressions, there are tons of them, are from this, that are in our language, and you don't even realize it's from here. Salt of the earth, fat of the land, the spirit is willing, the apple of his eye, bald as a coot, stranger in a strange land. Those are all from the King James Version of the Bible. So, but at that time, translation was dangerous. This book, so King James, I think we all know the story. King James said, you know, we're going to now have a new translation of the Bible. But in fact, it was based on William Tyndale's 1526 translation. You might remember William Tyndale. He might come up in Wolf Hall, Hilary Munt, that book. He was a brilliant translator, and he made a translation of the Bible at a time when it was forbidden. So he did it from Antwerp. He was in exile. Nevertheless, Henry VIII tracked him down and he was burned at the stake, although they strangled him first. This is the way, like if they wanted to be nice to you, they didn't just let you die. They killed you first quickly and then you. Yeah. So when they went to make this sick, and this was made by a committee of many, many people did the King James Version, made by a committee, but it was based on Tyndale's translation from 75 years before, which is this plain-spoken, beautiful English. You could argue it's at the time that the English language was at its absolute height. So this, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved over the face of the waters. Moved over the face of the waters. It's so great. When the King James, the first revision, they changed it, was hovering over the face of the waters and already kind of ruined it. Mm. Now, I know there are many, many translations, and the impetus is always, well, we have to make it understandable. This is the language of Shakespeare. This is exact same time. And I find it not that, I don't think it's that hard for us to understand Shakespeare. Chaucer is very hard to understand. Interestingly enough, Shakespeare also couldn't have understood Chaucer any better than we have. The language after Shakespeare didn't change that much. Anyway, one thing, this is just, and I'm not looking at it as a religious thing now, just as a thing of beauty. So Psalm 137, which is by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. Just this, these deeply moving passages that were translated here in a way that have woven themselves into the language. And this particular one was made into a great reggae song by the Melodians, mm-hmm. by the Rivers of Babylon. And later it was done as well. It's been done a few times. So when you're at church, or if they ever really use this translation, it's a wonderful thing. And forms just the basis of a lot of our language today, even if we don't realize
it. Yeah, it's interesting. Jill.
One of the things that makes me think of actually is poetry and the poetry of language and how poetry is translated. And Sibi Cavafy is a poet that I've read for a long time and is a poet that has been translated over and over and over again. And again, this sort of amazes me that one poem could require so many translations. But here's one little piece of one of the translations. This particular one was translated by Edmund Kelly and Philip Sherard, and it's called Morning Sea. And it is, this translation is completely different from other translations, but this one I particularly like. Let me stop here. Let me, too, look at nature a while. The brilliant blue of the morning sea, of the cloudless sky, the shore yellow, all lovely, all bathed in light. Let me stand here and let me pretend I see all this. I actually did see it for a minute when I first stopped. And not my usual daydreams here, too. My memories, those sensual images. And that's the whole poem. But the next translator takes that last line where he mentions the sensual images, and the last line becomes, and let me get to my right place in the book here, the last bit of it becomes, here let me stop, let me fool myself that these are what I see. I really saw them for a moment when I first stopped. Instead of seeing even here my fantasies, my recollections, the icons of pleasure. So it seems like a completely different poem. Sensual images versus the icons of pleasure. Mm. And not reading Greek, I have no idea which is more accurate or who is telling the who is reflecting on the poet best. And I think it's really hard. And so that,
which do you like better, though, in English? I mean, that's, see, I like the one with icon because that's a grabby image. The other one is kind of waffles on it. I mean, that's just my opinion.
Yes.
But if the poet could be awakened from the dead, like, he might hate it, right?
That's right. That's right. And which makes it, to be, it must be so hard to be a translator. I can't imagine.
But you have to, I'm sure they have to get a feel for what it's really about. What's the engine that's driving the story? And keep that in mind the whole time. Mm.
There's a great book actually called In Translation, Translators on Their Work and What It Means. And it has a really, it's a collection of essays on the art of translation. And the book lets you in on the thoughts of some of the leading literary translators. And they have this great section in here of translating. And we've been talking about translating to English, but this was about translating The Great Gatsby into Japanese, which Haruki Murakami, in fact, did that translation. And this whole essay in here is about what that was like for him to translate and how long it took him, that he wanted desperately to translate that into Japanese, but that he didn't know how to do it. And there's this one whole section in here talking about one particular phrase, which was old sport. And he writes, when I told Americans I was translating Gatsby, their first question was invariably, how are you going to translate Gatsby's Lee's pet phrase, old sport. And it takes him forever to figure out that he actually can't translate it, that he has to use that
old sport
phrase
in English
because it had so many connotations in the novel. Mm-hmm. So really fascinating stuff on how things are translated. This is called In Translation, Translators on Their Work and What It Means.
And the pressure you must feel, especially like something, like The Great Gatsby, a classic, you know, and you're the one who has to put it in this other language, I would imagine that'd be really a lot of pressure.
I think a lot of pressure. On the other hand, not too many people are going to judge how
the
well
English
you
versus
are going,
the
be
Japanese.
Able, are going to be able to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. What's your next book?
Well, I don't. Let me do The Brothers Grimm because they were, you know, these fairy tales that they did, and this I wasn't. They collected them. They didn't do much writing on their own, and they didn't actually do too much interviewing people. Although they did some, people came to them when they knew that they were doing this. So when they first published it in 1812, but over the years they made many many additions, changing it, and they always made it more bourgeois value, more prettified. So I wanted to see what these originals are like, and they're kind of amazing. Now, I don't know all of them. I didn't know all of them, but let's take Rapunzel. We all remember Rapunzel, but this is what the original looked like. You know, so Rapunzel hears, I mean, the knight, the prince, you know, she's in a tower and he wants to see her, but never knows how. But then this fairy woman does the first call, Rapunzel, Rapunzel. And then he copies it and she lets him in. Okay. So he does Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair. So she let her hair drop. And when her braids were at the bottom of the tower, he tied them around him and she pulled him up. At first, Rapunzel was terribly afraid, but soon the young prince pleased her so much that she agreed to see him every day and pull him up into the tower. Thus, for a while, they had a merry time and enjoyed each other's company. The fairy did not become aware of this until one day Rapunzel began talking and said to her, "Tell me, Mother Gothel, why are my clothes becoming too tight? They don't fit me anymore." "Oh, you godless child," the fairy replied. "What's this I hear?" And suddenly the subtext of Rapunzel is so clear to me. And they're all like that. They're much darker and more violent. They're not kids' stories at all. They're stories with kids in them. So The Brothers Grimm, this translation is by Jack Zipes, and I love it. But these are so much more forceful in their original dark, foresty way. So The Brothers Grimm, I don't know about reading them to your kids.
No. Check them out first anyway, right? All right, Jill.
Well, I want to just mention Clarice Lispector, who is another author I discovered in Rio. And the guy, it turns out, that translated all the Luis Alfredo Garcia Rosa books actually has written a biography of Clarice Lispector. Her first novel was called Near to the Wild Heart. And she is one of those authors that is loved dearly by other authors and is not generally known by the public. She writes very sort of mysterious things. And as one person said, here's a sort of description of it. The novel is made up of a series of stream of consciousness passages. So if you hate stream of consciousness, you're not going to like this book, centering on the thoughts and actions of the young Joanna after the death of her father. And they're really fascinating. She also, there's a recent book of translated collected stories by her. There's a biography out now about Clarice Lispector. One of her wonderful essays is called The Egg and the Chicken. It's listed both in a collection of essays and in a book of short stories. You'll have to read it to decide what you think it is. Clarice Lispector, right. Great writer.
Peter, you're going to be at the West Falmouth Library tomorrow, 6:30, talking about your new book.
Yes, but I'll take questions on translations. I'm going to talk about The Right Side and also the Chet and Bernie books.
All right. And we're going to go out with By the Rivers of Babylon by the Melodians. Any quick thought you want to say on that?
I love the way it turned into reggae.
All right, author Peter Abraham, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
By the rivers of Babylon, where he sat down, and there he went when he remembers Zion. Was the wicked carried us away, captivity? From us a song.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle.